Chaos reigned around the decision-makers on site in Valdez on Friday and Saturday. Local fishermen arrived at hastily arranged press conferences at the town's civic center, shouted questions, made speeches, and threatened to take the cleanup into their own hands. On the stage at the makeshift press conferences stood Exxon employees wearing three-piece suits, recalled Dennis Kelso, then in charge of Alaska's Department of Environmental Conservation. Meanwhile, in the crowd, there was so much fear and anger, you could hear it crackling through the audience. Valdez was a small and isolated town. Local oil and government representatives struggled to make early decisions about response options while consulting with their superiors over long-distance telephone lines. There were multiple sources of overlapping authority: the Coast Guard, the State of Alaska, the Pipeline Consortium, and Exxon. British Petroleum, the lead owner of the Pipeline Consortium, Alyeska, was supposed to have ensured that preparations for response to an oil spill in the Sound would be adequate, but the consortium had failed to equip Tiny Valdez with adequate boats, vehicles, boom, leased aircraft, and other vital materials. The Coast Guard had emergency procedures to respond to oil spills and had supervised cleanups in the Gulf of Mexico and elsewhere, but it, too, lacked the equipment to take full charge in Prince William Sound. Exxon lacked the equipment as well, because it had been relying on the BP-led pipeline consortium to take on this responsibility. But Exxon had more experience, as a senior Coast Guard officer put it, so the Coast Guard yielded to the corporation. Raymond later said that Exxon had access to a lot of cleanup equipment on the ground, but he blamed Alaskan officials for not granting permission to use it. He also deflected any suggestion that his and Rawls' decision to lay off Exxon's oil spill specialists during their cost-cutting spree had in any way hindered the corporation's response. "We have people all over the world trained to handle oil spills, even if they don't have the exact title of oil spill specialist." Fishermen and Valdez believed that spraying chemical dispersants would do more harm than good to salmon and other fish populations on which they depended. Hundreds of thousands of young salmon were about to be released into the Sound. If they swam through toxic oil driven beneath the surface by dispersants, they might be destroyed before they reached maturity. Locals voiced these fears to Steve Cooper and his advisors. Cooper authorized a few tests, which did not turn out promisingly. The chemicals were dumped accidentally onto cleanup crews. Coast Guard officers were not enthusiastic about using dispersants based on the available advice. Neither Alaskan state officials nor Environmental Protection Agency specialists recommended going forward aggressively. Lee Raymond fumed. Running limited experiments in these circumstances was like testing the fire hose after the house is on fire, he thought. He accepted that in cases where the chemistry of oil and water was unknown, a dispersant plan might best be implemented cautiously, but that was not the case here. "There is only one kind of crude on a vessel leaving Valdez," he said later. He was referring to the fact that only well-known Alaska crude blends came down the pipeline, and their chemistry had been well studied. "It is one of the most susceptible of all crude oils to dispersants. Therefore, that information didn't need to be established." Early in his Exxon career, Raymond had worked at the lab that developed Core Exit, the dispersant available to use in the Sound. He felt he knew the issues from the molecular level on up, but Exxon executives on the scene kept telling him that the state and special interest groups trying to influence the state were opposed to using Exxon's previously approved dispersants, and Dennis Kelso in particular was flat opposed. Alaskan officials and federal scientists later concluded that there had been neither enough chemicals nor delivery systems to make a decisive impact in the time available. But Raymond held just as firmly to the opposite view. The deeper this conviction took hold of him in the days ahead, the more it seemed to harden his belief that once the oil began to pour into Prince William Sound, the corporation acted blamelessly, while environmentalists did not. "I asked you a moment ago what, if anything, you felt Exxon did wrong. And I think your answer began by saying, well, you didn't really think it was a matter of right and wrong." Jim Sherman, a lawyer for the state of Alaska, asked Raymond later at a deposition. "Well, I don't mean to be argumentative, But assigning blame isn't the same as being right or wrong, Raymond said. Well, do you think the state of Alaska's actions in the first 72 hours after the spill in regard to dispersant use were wrong? My own view is that dispersants should have been applied. If you are suggesting that the state didn't think they should be applied, then I guess we would have a difference of view. And since I'm right, I guess by your supposition, you are wrong. By those same terms, did Exxon do anything in the course of the weeks that followed the spill that was wrong? The state may have a view on that, and I have a different view. I'm asking for your view, sir. I'm never going to say that we are always doing everything exactly right. I would be naive to do that. But if you are asking me, are there any major decision points that we faced in how to respond to that spill, that in hindsight we would go back and say we think we were wrong? And I don't think there are any.